From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. lawmakers press President Obama to take action in Syria after reports the Assad regime probably used chemical weapons in the two-year-old civil war there. The president's own red line has been crossed, they argue. Not so fast, pushes back the administration. We need more information. Slow down. Let's not rush in. This hour on Point, the red line and what to do about Syria. You can join us on air or online. What do you want the U.S. to do? How should the U.S. respond? Are you ready to arm the rebels? What does the U.S. and the world owe the Syrian people? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Beirut, Lebanon, is Ann Barnard, Beirut bureau chief for The New York Times. She's been covering the ongoing conflict in Syria from inside and outside the country. Ann Barnard, welcome back to On Point.
Anna, thank you so much.
Welcome. Let's start with the news today in Syria of an apparent assassination attempt of the Syrian prime minister. Can you update us on the latest news there?
Yes. Both opposition and government sources say that while the prime minister was traveling in Mezza, which is a relatively secure area of Damascus, his convoy was hit by a bomb. He is reported to have survived, but we're not sure of his condition.
All right. So then let's go to the chemical weapons at issue here in this hour. And last week, President Obama chose his words carefully, but he said that Syria has probably used chemical weapons. That's a U.S. confirmation for the first time, right? Not an international one. Why is that significant, Anne?
Yes, I think, as you said, the president is looking for clearer evidence, but this is the strongest statement that we've heard from the White House so far.
All right. Here's some sound, actually, speaking this past August of the president calling the use of chemical weapons in Syria a red line. Here he is.
We have been very clear to the Assad regime, but also to other players on the ground that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus. That would change my equation.
And then here he is on Friday, the president speaking about the confirmed reports of chemical weapons use in Syria before meeting with King Abdullah II of Jordan, where many Syrian refugees have indeed fled.
It's obviously horrific as it is when mortars are being fired on civilians and people are being indiscriminately killed. To use potential weapons of mass destruction on civilian populations crosses another line with respect to international norms and international law. And that is going to be a game changer.
And what's the reaction to this news in Syria and across the region? Has there been any admission by the Syrian government that chemical weapons indeed have been used?
No, absolutely not. And I think right now they are trying very hard to convince the West that the West should back off its support of the rebels.
Okay. And what evidence does the U.S. have then? Why now? Why has this come forward now? Where do they find their evidence of chemical weapons use in Syria?
Well, other governments like the Israelis and the British have talked about having evidence of the use of chemical weapons, if perhaps in a limited way. But we still don't know exactly the nature of the evidence. Is it physiological samples? Is it signals intelligence? Is it human intelligence? And we have to remember that the rebels themselves are highly incentivized to say that the chemical weapons have been used because of the statements that President Obama has looked for, that there still hasn't been game-changing aid for the opposition from the United States. And this is something that, of course, the dynamics are quite different in many ways from the situation around the intervention in Iraq, but that cloud is hanging heavily over this decision as well.
Ann Barnard, thank you very much. We're relying on a satellite phone that is obviously tricky there. I appreciate your time, and thank you very much for joining us. Ann Barnard is the Beirut bureau chief for The New York Times. Let's go now to Norman, Oklahoma. Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes the blog Syria Comment. Josh Landis, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Jane.
And with us also from Doha, Qatar, is Sadi Hamid, director of research at the Brookings Doha Center and a fellow at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute. Shadid, welcome back to On Point to you as well.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
So, Josh, let me go to you. I mean, it was tricky there a little bit to hear Anne, but tell us why this, why now?
Well, because there have been a number of allegations that Syria has used chemical weapons, about 10 people killed in a town outside of Aleppo. The Syrian regime has tried to blame it on the opposition. Some people said that it wasn't sarin gas, which others are saying it was. There's still a lot of question marks. The Syrian opposition, though, is adamant, saying, look, 80,000 people have been killed so far. This is much worse than any use of chemical weapons. America needs to intervene and save us today. It raises the question of, does America want to get involved in Syria and intervene in Syria?
Shadi, so much has been made of the red line. President Obama often warned Syrian President Bashar al-Assad about using chemical weapons. He said that wielding them would cross this red line. It would be a game changer, he said, for U.S. policy with enormous consequences, quote unquote. Help us understand that language as it relates to the events of the last few days.
Yeah, well, that was supposedly the red line, but if you look at what Obama actually said, he said a whole bunch of chemical weapons need to be used. Now, what defines a whole bunch? So that's when you get into this blurriness. But I think Obama's initial statements were actually quite dangerous, because if you say that chemical weapons are a red line, you're implying that everything short of that is not a red line. So in other words, the slaughter of 70,000 Syrians is not a red line. Having nearly 3 million internally displaced is not a red line.
Do you agree with that, Josh Landis?
Well, that's true. I mean, America has entered into two civil wars in the Middle East in the last decade, and we've spent $40,000 per household. That's the estimated debt that every American household has taken on. And Obama is very reluctant to go into a third. And I think most Americans do not want him to go in. He, you know, his political future is on the line. And so he's weighing the costs and the benefits. And Syria is not an important country for the United States. That's the real problem. Now, Israel wants America to go in and get rid of the chemical weapons. Turkey would like America to go in. Lebanon, Jordan. Everybody wants America and Uncle Sam to clean up Syria for them, because it's a nightmare in the region, and it is a terrible human cost. But Obama has his foot on the brake. He does not want to get sucked in, because to take out chemical weapons would mean destroying the Syrian military, putting boots on the ground if you want to do it right. I mean, you could just bomb them. But the trouble is, if you just bomb the sites, you're going to have a lot of chemical weapons exposed, and the opposition and potentially al-Qaeda is going to be able to take them. So in order to do it right, you need to put – the New York Times, talking to defense officials, has said it would take 70,000 American troops on the ground. And once you do that, take out the Syrian army, you're into Iraq. Mm-hmm. You're in the same situation. You own it. And Obama clearly does not want to own Syria.
And yet Shadi – yes, go ahead, please.
I mean, I would disagree strongly with that characterization. No one is calling for boots on the ground. No one is calling for an Iraq-style invasion. What those of us who have called for intervention are saying is, let's find ways to diminish the regime's ability to kill its own people. And that could include through the use of surgical airstrikes, air power to protect certain areas controlled by the rebels, the idea of safe zones. I mean, there's a lot of different proposals out there, but no one, to my knowledge, has said, let's put 70,000 boots on the ground. So that's why I think when the shadow of Iraq comes up, and that's understandable, it was a disaster, Syria couldn't be more different, because we're not talking about that sort of invasion.
And so, Josh Landis, would that be enough? Surgical airstrikes, safe zones, maybe no-fly zones. Would that enough? Would that be enough to do the trip?
Shadi has been calling for this, as many people have, from the beginning. It's got nothing to do with chemical weapons. But the chemical weapons problem is very different. Obama has clearly said, you know, chemical weapons are a red line if they're being used. Obviously, now the red line is shifting. But in order to get rid of chemical weapons, the U.S. administration and Defense Department have estimated that you need to put boots on the ground, because they are scattered around Syria. They don't want them to fall into the hands of al-Qaeda or other opposition or Salafist groups. This is particularly Israel's concern, and I think America is very sensitive to that. And so if you just want the rebels to win, America can do that without putting boots on the ground. But that raises the whole question of who's going to own these chemical weapons next, which is really, for Israel, is the massive concern because they do not want the rebels to own these chemical weapons. So America is in a difficult position here. They can help the rebels win by no-fly zones and not putting boots, but by just destroying Assad's military, but the way they did in Libya. But that raises the whole question of what comes next, who's going to rule Syria, and who gets those chemical weapons.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about reports of chemical weapons use in Syria and President Obama's red line. We're speaking this hour with Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And joining me also from Doha, Qatar, is Shadi Hamid, director of research at the Brookings Doha Center and a fellow at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute. So let's hear some sound now from Arizona Senator John McCain. Here he is speaking on Thursday of last week in Washington. He's calling for action from the White House in response to Syria's use of chemical weapons.
The President of the United States said that if the Bashar Assad used chemical weapons, it would be a game changer, that it would cross a red line. I think it's pretty obvious that red line has been crossed.
And it's not just Republicans. California Democrat Senator Dianne Feinstein also expressed concern on Thursday, saying, quote, President Assad may calculate he has nothing more to lose and the likelihood he will further escalate this conflict therefore increases. It's also important that the world understands the use of weapons of mass destruction will not be allowed. And clearly, Assad must go. Josh Landis, how loud are those bipartisan voices on this issue in Washington, and how much does the president listen?
Well, the president hasn't been listening to most of these voices. I don't – you know, Donald Trump said the other day – he said, isn't there one of these we're going to stay out of? And I think that's the debate in America is – there are many people who want to embarrass the president, and the chemical weapons issue is, of course, a very dangerous issue. The United States needs to form a coalition with Turkey, Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, other local powers that are interested who are willing to put boots on the ground in order to stop these chemical weapons. It would be foolhardy for the United States just to go in there and do this on its own.
But getting that done is going to be difficult. Yeah, Shadi, this notion of the red line that we've been talking about, this past rhetoric of President Obama now actually meeting reality, how much wiggle room is there now for him to follow through given his past statements? Has he indeed boxed himself into a corner on this?
I don't think so. He can wiggle a lot more, and he's already doing that, as other senior U.S. officials have been doing. And they use a lot of kind of hard to understand diplomatic speak about the exact nature of the attacks, the chain of custody, who, what, where, when, and why, where exactly in Syria was it used. I mean, there's a lot of ways to avoid taking action if you don't want to take action. And as Josh, I think, rightly pointed out, this is a president that does not want to get involved in Syria under any circumstances. So he'll put this off as long as humanely possible.
Here's more sound from Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel speaking on Thursday from Abu Dhabi. He's announcing that chemical weapons indeed have been used in the Syrian conflict.
The U.S. intelligence community assesses with some degree of varying confidence that the Syrian regime has used chemical weapons on a small scale in Syria.
Joshua Landis, who first reported this chemical weapons use? When do we think it happened? Is this a recent event?
Well, it's a few weeks ago in a town outside of Aleppo. The opposition pointed out there were people dying in the town on the streets, and they had white foam coming from their mouth, and their eyes were bugging out. There were aerial shots of this. The Israelis went over and said this is consistent with the use of some sort of chemical weapons. You know, there was a lot of regime wiggling, trying to say, oh, this wasn't us. It was the opposition. It was this is some kind of tear gas gone wrong? You know, all those questions came up. But, you know, obviously Obama made the decision a few days ago not to try to wiggle out of this that way. And he, you know, the criticism from McCain and others was growing louder and louder. And so he just said, well, it could very well have been the use, and we're going to investigate this. He punted it to the UN where it would die an ignominious death. And he's stepping closer. And it raised the question, what happens when chemical weapons are used? And many people think that line is going to come. And the United States has drawn red lines. Israel is saying, look, if you punt on this, you're going to punt on Iran. And for us, we want to bomb Iran and stop them from getting nuclear ability to refine. And so it raises a whole bunch of other issues in the area that our allies are very concerned about.
Shadi, why this degree of varying confidence, as the White House says? Why not complete confidence that this happens? Why the backstroke a little bit here? What do we not know at this point?
Well, I think that, you know, they're concerned, obviously, about the legacy of Iraq, that if you're talking about weapons of mass destruction, you have to be 100% completely sure before you move forward, especially if you're going to justify military intervention. So I think that's part of it. And but, I mean, the use of chemical weapons is not always the most clear-cut thing, and that's why they're talking about a verification, about a UN investigation, to kind of have more certainty about how it was used and who used it. And there's also a question of intent. Did the Syrian regime, with Assad's knowledge, actually purposely deploy chemical weapons, or were there some other set of circumstances?
And so what's the process then of further verifying these claims of the use of chemical weapons? I assume it's not likely that there's going to be an independent verification at the site of this suspected attack. I mean, what do you talk to patients? You look at eyewitness accounts? I mean, what's the process here, Shadid?
I think those are all elements of it, but it's going to be hard to have the level of 100% certainty that maybe some people are hoping for. But the bottom line is that verification process is going to take time. So the problem here is that it further delays action. And this is a situation where the longer this conflict goes on, the more radicalization you see, the stronger jihadists are on the ground, the more killing. And that's what it really comes down to, where we're talking about several hundred killed on a daily basis. So if we wait 1 month, 2 months, we're going to be talking about thousands more potentially killed. So there is a real sense of urgency, and that's why punting it off to the UN is problematic, in my view.
Let's go to the phone lines here in Troy, Alabama. Francisco is on the line. Hi, Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi. Well, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to make the point that despite there being chemical weapons that were used, more than likely, the United States still seems to have its hands tied, just because it seems like all the options that have been used before, from our historical experience, don't seem to have worked. For instance, when we armed the rebels, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, when we use the fly zone in Libya, we're not really sure what the effect of that is going to still be, because that's still an open case. So it seems to me that the effort should be based on a humanitarian focus, where we should be trying to help people this way, because otherwise it's going to be sort of a quagmire like we've had. And then, of course, also we have no appetite for war in the United States. So it's going to be difficult, I think, to mobilize people for that kind of an effort. And we can be sure that if we do get involved militarily, there'll be all sorts of scandals, there'll be crimes. And this is just going to diminish support for the United States in the long run.
Francisco, thank you. Josh Landis, should U.S. involvement be really based more on humanitarian efforts?
Well, it should really be based on what can America do confidently when it enters. And, you know, Shadi raised the question of, is it America's lack of leadership that's causing the radicalization in Syria, the fact that we didn't intervene? And this is where I think we disagree fairly profoundly. Syria is going through a national meltdown in the same way Iraq and Afghanistan have. You know, it is not the fact that we did not intervene that's causing the radicalization in Syria. We intervened in Iraq. In 3 short weeks, we destroyed the regime, cleared out the Ba'ath Party, dissolved the army, and then Iraq radicalized. People started joining al-Qaeda because there's an intense civil war and disagreement over the very basic nature and identity of the state. And that's happening in Syria. People are going to radicalize. It's not because America is not going in. If America goes in there, it's going to radicalize even faster. And can America decide and build a state in Syria and give them a constitution and democracy? I don't think we can build this nation state. And that's the dilemma for the United States. We sit by with our hands in our pockets because we don't have an answer for this problem. We didn't have an answer in Iraq. Yeah.
Shadi, would you respond?
Yeah, sure. So if we had intervened when the call started a year and a half ago, that would have prevented radicalization because at that point, Jabhat al-Nusra and other radical groups hadn't emerged with the kind of strength that we see right now. And it's just a basic fact that in militarized situations, the better fighters are going to rise to the top. And whether we like it or not, it's the Salafi extremists who tend to be battle-hardened, who tend to have better access to resources and to weapons, partly because the U.S. and its allies are not supporting the more moderate alternatives as much as they should. So if we had, if the U.S. along with its allies, Qatar, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, France, the U.K. had gone in and with airstrikes, creating safe zones, helping the rebels win a year and a half ago, then we wouldn't be in the position we are today. So it would have been a preventative action. But I think Josh is right. It's partly a little, you know, it's a little bit too late now. So even if we intervene, say, tomorrow, a lot of the damage has already been done. So I do acknowledge that.
Let's go to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi, John. You're on the line. Welcome.
I just want to say that we need to completely stay out of Syria. The al-Nusra Front is the strongest army on the ground there. It's an extremist army. It hates America. And if this guy falls in Syria, they're going to be the ones that take over power because the Free Syrian Army don't have a chance in the world to run these guys out. Another thing, that no-fly zone that you guys are talking about, that'll never happen. The Russians got an aircraft carrier over there flying 24/7 patrols. I don't know how they're going to set up a no-fly zone, and the Russians are just going to sit back and allow you to do that. I don't see that happening. I think that that's just crazy talk.
John, thank you very much for your call. Shadi, there's John, and I'm certain many others in the U.S. population really don't have much of a stomach for another foreign involvement after Iraq and Afghanistan. To that, you say what?
Well, I'm not actually sure if that's the case. I think if President Obama made the case to the American people that 70,000 people have been slaughtered with many more tortured and raped, I think Americans would be receptive to that because there is a real humanitarian consideration here. And I think if it's explained clearly that we're not talking about 100,000 troops or boots on the ground and that the focus would be on eliminating the military assets of the regime through air power as part of a coalition. Again, it wouldn't just be the U.S. because others want us to intervene more than we do, oddly enough. So I think if all of that was made clear, you'd see more of an openness. And the other thing I would say is when people say, yes, what happens after Assad falls? There are extremists, so on and so forth. But Assad is going to fall regardless of whether we intervene. The question is, how long do we wait? And how many people die in the process? I think it would be better for Assad to fall sooner rather than later. Those are the two options we have there.
Josh Landis, could President Obama, to your mind, make the argument for involvement here that Americans would embrace?
You know, the president has a great deal of power, and he might be able to if he really wanted to expend all of his political capital and gamble on this and figure that the third time's a charm. But, you know, the American people are exhausted. We're in debt. People, you know, the middle class is falling in its income power. It's a real uphill battle. And Obama is interested in the American middle class, not in the Middle East. And that's the real problem. He's not going to make that decision. He's been trying to keep us out. He's trying to get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan. He does not want to get sucked into Syria, a country in which we've had no traditional interest. We've had sanctions on it since the 70s. And it doesn't have oil. It doesn't have wealth. It is waiting to suck us in. And we've tried, you know, to encourage the Turks, the Israelis, I mean, the Saudis, the Arab League to go in and take charge of the situation. It's their neighborhood. They're the ones who are threatened. They don't want to. They see Syria as a swamp, just the way Iraq was. They do not want to get sucked in. They're all say, America, Uncle Sam can pay for this. They can do it. They've got the army. They've got the Air Force. And that's why Obama doesn't want to get sucked in. He's said, we'll go in second if you go in first.
Let's go to Bethesda, Maryland. Marcel is on the line. Hi, Marcel. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I think what I'm seeing here, unfortunately, is you're going to see a parallel to what happened in Rwanda. We use semantics. We said genocide's not happening there. Acts of genocide are happening. And here we're saying, oh, yes, you can drop bombs on hospitals, on schools, fill up citizens with bullets, but chemical weapons are the difference. I think Obama will regret this the same way Clinton did, using semantics to fail to intervene where you have mass casualties.
Marcel, thank you. Shadi, I'll turn to you on that point. Marcel sees a parallel to Rwanda. Do you? Shadi? I think we'd lost Shadi. Josh, what do you think about that? Do you see the parallel to Rwanda?
Well, there are parallels. You know, there are parallels to Congo. There are many places where people are dying and there's terrible civil wars. You know, we're about to leave Afghanistan, and that's going to light up again. Iraq has 50, 60 people being killed a day. Many people are warning that it's going to go back into civil war. The United States could put boots on the ground in every one of these places. That's the problem is we're exhausted with this nation building. And of course, there is a moral dilemma, and your caller is absolutely right. It's very tough as human beings to watch this kind of terrible destruction and killing. The international community is failing, and the United States has been the superpower, the indispensable nation that's gone in and put out a lot of these terrible fires. And the trouble is today we've become weaker. We're not economically up to it, and this raises the great question of how do we build some kind of international structure that – something, some alternative. It's a dilemma, and there's no good answer for it.
So, Josh Landis, where is the White House on this now? Is this sort of a wait-and-see mode? We wait for 100% verification of chemical attack and then move forward if we do anything at all?
You know, the president is praying that that Assad's not going to really use weapons in any big way, that he's not going to get sucked in, that I'm sure he's gone to Russia and said, you've got to read Assad the Riot Act, because if he does this, we're going to be forced to go in. And he's trying to make that point to Assad and to all of Assad's supporters, Iran, Russia, so that this dilemma does not force him to, you know, turn his presidency into a Syrian war presidency. And that's I'm sure that's what everybody in Washington is, you know, wiping their brows and thinking, boy, I hope we can get out of this one.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Syria and chemical weapons, and you can join the conversation. We're speaking this hour with Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and Shadi Hamid, director of research at the Brookings Doha Center. He's in Doha, Qatar for us today. Here's a clip from Sunday, Arizona Senator John McCain speaking with Meet the Press from Sedona, Arizona, about what the president's red line means for the conflict in Syria.
What has happened here is the president drew red lines about chemical weapons, thereby giving a green light to Bashar Assad to do anything short of that, including Scud missiles and helicopter gunships and air strikes and mass executions and atrocities that are on a scale that we have not seen in a long, long time.
Joshua Landis, what about this argument that by defining a red line and then not acting on it right away, that we are essentially encouraging more bad behavior by President Assad and additionally losing credibility in the region?
Well, it's true that, you know, our red line is now moved. And that, of course, makes you look weak. If we go in and invade Syria and destroy their military, we're not going to make any friends in the Middle East. We've done this several times before, and our ratings are at an all-time low. You know, we're not going to be loved in the Middle East for what we do in Syria. The Syrians, you know, ultimately have to figure this out. In America, during our civil war, 750,000 people were killed. We were only 34 million people in 1860. Syria is 24 million people. 100,000 have been killed. It raises, you know, we as America, looking back on it today, I think very few Americans would have wanted an outside power to intervene in the United States and to keep Americans from killing each other in such massive numbers.
That's not to say.
I mean, it just raises a question of can we solve, you know, can an outside power solve a civil war in a country? I mean, this is every country has gone through a terrible, bloody civil war. And I don't know how we can stop Syria from going through this. And this is where Shadi and I disagree profoundly. He thinks that a no-fly zone would have stopped al-Qaeda from getting into Syria. I don't think so. Al-Qaeda is going to get in there. There is not a clear Syrian leadership. The Syrian opposition that America supports has had three presidents in the last 2 weeks. Mm-hmm, they keep on changing. Mm-hmm.
Shadi, jump in here. We've got you back, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, the bigger issue here is American credibility, not just among Syrians, but among Arabs across the region. We've essentially sent them the message that there's been an Arab Spring, but it's business as usual. The U.S. only cares about a very narrow set of security interests. We care about maybe chemical weapons or Iran, but when it comes to tens of thousands of Arabs being killed, we will not act. The Arab Spring was supposed to have forced us as Americans to fundamentally reassess the way we looked at the region. We had been supporting dictatorships for decades, and being part and playing a role in the destruction of the region. Now we have a chance to get it right. So I think a lot of Syrians and Arabs are looking now and saying, "What's going on here?" And I would just disagree with Josh's point. On one thing, in Libya, Libya is the only country in the Arab world where the U.S. has high favorability ratings. Why? Because we were on their side when they were suffering, and we supported their struggle against Gaddafi in 2011. So things like this do make a difference, and Syrians, too, will remember who was by their side. What I'm hearing from Syrians now is anti-Americanism, that the U.S. is actually trying to hurt Syria and prevent Syria from moving forward, because they say if the U.S. wanted to act, it could have, but it hasn't.
Well, to that point, here's some sound from the prime minister of the Syrian opposition, Ghassan Hito, the National Coalition's interim government leader, said chemical weapons have been used and should not be the U.S.'s red line for getting involved in the conflict. This is an interview with CBS's Holly Williams.
We are certain that this regime has used chemical weapons against the Syrian people.
The White House says that it still needs conclusive evidence.
President Barack Obama, with all due respect for him, the price of the first child who died in Daraa is far more important than waiting for conclusive evidence of use of chemical weapons for him to do something. That was too much of a price for the Syrian people and too much of a price to be placed on the conscience of America.
Shadi, your response to that?
I mean, I agree with the sentiment here. America is not some normal country like everyone else, not to go too much into exceptionalist territory here, but the world, including Syrians, still look to the U.S. for moral and political leadership in their time of need. We saw the same thing in Libya. They were literally begging for the U.S. to get involved, saying, "We need your help. Yes, we have some differences. We don't like U.S. foreign policy on other things, but the U.S. is the only country that has the capability to stop this slaughter." And that's the bottom line. So when people say, "Well, why doesn't the Arab League do something, or Saudi Arabia and Turkey?" The answer is pretty simple, because they can't do it on their own. They need U.S. military support to be able to bring the regime down. And yes, so we can talk about U.S. decline all we want, but the U.S. is still, whether we like it or not, the indispensable nation.
Let's go to Gloucester, Massachusetts. April is on the line. Hi, April. Thank you for waiting and welcome to the program.
How are you? I just wanted to make the point that, you know, this comes up every couple of years. We leave one, you know, hot spot, and someone's always going to need our help. And, you know, it's a horrible situation, granted, but we are not financially secure enough at this point to be running into every single spot that needs help. We've got to get our own ducks in a row, because we're going to be looking at similar circumstances in 20 years from now? We're going to be looking at our own problems in this country if we don't get ourselves in order.
April, thank you very much. Here's another call from Jerome in Decatur, Illinois. Jerome, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello. I think that we are already in too deep in the Middle East. Their country's over there. They have airplanes. They have a lot of reasons, religious reasons and all, to work with the Syrian people and the Syrian opposition to get this thing solved. We need to stop getting involved over there because, number one, we don't even know who we're dealing with. So I think it's time for us to push them to the table. They have jet planes. They can build islands out in the water. They have the money and the resources, the oil-rich sheiks. Get them involved.
All right, Jerome, thank you. And here's Jeff from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Jeff. Welcome.
How you doing today, Jane?
Hi, good.
I got a little quick note here as far as for saying that, and I kind of agree with just before me, is that the fact that we've got our own financial problems in this country. We've got to get our own stuff straight. I think that as far as for if they want us to be the policemen of the world, that's what the UN is for. That's what it was established. I think that anything countries crying for help need to go to the UN, since the UN has all these other nations that can pull their finances together. Since I don't think of any other country, Saudi Arabia, any one of those other ones that have money that we're protecting, are they paying us for this service or are we paying them to be there? Which I don't understand that. I look at it this way. We've got to get our own house in order. Then, at that point, if you want us to police the world, that's great. But that's what the UN is for. You know, Syria, Libya, anybody of these other Middle Eastern countries want our help. They need to support it. And if we're involved with it, I don't think any companies that have been involved in past wars, i.e. Halliburton, that they should be allowed to have any contact at all with any other type of invasion or whatever.
I hear it, Jeff. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Josh Landis, I think I'm hearing a theme here among our callers. Not much appetite for moving into Syria in any form, really.
Well, I think Americans are feeling beaten down and very anxious about their own future, and they should, because we are just building up a debt at an incredible pace, and both Democrats and Republicans are failing to deal with it. And this, you know, this just opens the question of how can America continue to put out civil wars and these difficult situations. And, you know, living in America, I look at my public schools and they're not getting better. And we just made the decision to put our kids in a private school, and we're feeling completely beset. And that's what most Americans, I think, are thinking about.
You know what,
how do they pay it?
We haven't talked about Shahid, go ahead. Jump in.
Yeah. Well, there's two things here. So the caller said we have to get our house in order as Americans, but people have to recognize this does affect our house. When terrorism spreads and extremists gain a foothold in a place like Syria, that has after effects for decades potentially. And God forbid it could come back to haunt us in 10, 20 years. So we can't just pretend that America is this island that isn't affected by the destabilization going on in the region. And as for the argument that we don't have the financial capability, I don't buy that for one second. Why? Libya cost us about $1 billion to intervene there. Even if Syria costed 10 times more than that, $10 billion is a microscopic amount when you look at America's overall GDP. This is not a question about economic resources, it's about political will.
You know what we haven't talked about this hour is if and when Bashar al-Assad does go, who fills the void? And I'm reading so much about the opposition in Syria now linked to groups like al-Qaeda. And I'm curious from both of you, how much frustration do you think there is on the part of the United States about the inability to nurture a more secular military, a more secular political opposition? The White House must be weighing this greatly as it weighs its options here. Shadid, you first.
Yeah, well, I think that this idea that we can find and build and nurture the perfect, nice, fluffy, secular opposition and then we can act is very misguided. I mean, the bottom line is there aren't a lot of secularists among the fighting forces in Syria. I mean, what we're really talking about is different shades of Islamism. Are we talking about, mainstream palatable Islamists, or are we talking about the extremists on the other end? The unfortunate reality is that in wars, in situations of war, the extremists are going to tend to do better because, as I said earlier, they tend to be the better fighters. They're the ones who have the battle experience from other conflicts, and they're the ones who have access to better weapons and resources and support. So I think, unfortunately, again, the longer this goes on, the more those groups are going to gain a foothold. And in that sense, it may be too late to reverse that trend.
So, Josh Landis, would an al-Qaeda fueled opposition in power after Assad actually be worse than the Assad regime?
Well, just today we published on Syria Comment a long post about what's happening in the northeast of Syria, where al-Qaeda went into a town had a tribal town had taken over an oil well and stole a truck, an oil truck, from these al-Qaeda Nusra guys who had taken over a lot of the oil wells in the region. And al-Qaeda came into that town, killed about 50 people, blew up 14 houses, and made a big video of it, which we have on our site. And they're warning anybody who moves against them that this is what's going to happen to you. And they call these people apostates and so forth. And unfortunately, this is an area where the Assad regime withdrew very quickly without fighting. It's not an area – I mean, it's an example of what's going to happen in Syria, how things may unfold, and new social forces that are rising up in Syria that America has nothing to do with. If America had put a no-fly zone over this area, it would have made no difference whether those people came in from al-Qaeda and took over this region. It wouldn't have prevented it. This sort of thing is going to go on in Syria for some time, as we've seen in Iraq, where al-Qaeda is very lively today, or in Afghanistan, where we have been unable to tamp out these forces. And I just don't see how America is going to stop this. Al-Qaeda is a real fear for America. It has paralyzed it. If America were willing to invest billions of dollars, we could affect the outcome somewhat. But we've spent, you know, $1 trillion in Iraq, and we did affect the outcome. But it's not one we like. And I think the same thing is going on in Afghanistan. We've proven that even with this expenditure of billions of dollars, we can't get the outcome we want. And in Syria, we're not going to get that outcome.
Let me get one more call in here from Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Laura. I'm glad you called. Thank you very much for waiting. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll make this brief. I just wanted to give a counterpoint to the last couple of callers that, you know, part of getting our house in order here is having our foreign policy be sustainable. And as we know from the Boston bombings, these are people that have had angst, and it's very hard to explain, of course, for them, but this is the kind of feeling people have in the world, that they look to America as the moral authority. We can't even do that here at home. So we've got to, yes, fix our own house, but at the same time, we've got to support democracy and free thinking. And we can't do that if we don't go into these places. And I think we should have gotten in there a long time ago. I agree with one of your guests about that. Thank you.
Laura, thank you very much. Shadia and Josh, look into the future for us in our last minute and a half here. How do you see Syria in 1 year, 5 years down the road? Shadia, you first.
Well, I can't even pretend to be optimistic. Again, a lot of the damage has been done, but I think there is hope in terms of getting rid of Assad and making sure his regime falls sooner rather than later. That is still possible. Without outside intervention, he could stay on for several more years, and we're going to see it getting worse from day to day for quite a while. So I think what we have to focus on here is how do we get Assad out of power? How do we assist the rebels in gaining more territory and finally being able to dislodge Assad from power? Because we can have all these debates about what Syria looks like 10 or 20 years from now, but if Assad doesn't fall, then a lot of that discussion is moot.
Shadi, thank you. Josh Landis, 20 seconds before you hit or wrap us up.
Well, I agree with Shadi that this looks very bleak. Syria is going to be – there are over 1,000 militias operating in Syria today. This civil war is going to go on for a long time. There are many disagreements, and is unlikely to be boots on the ground to sort this out by any outside power.
Josh Landis, Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Josh, thank you as always. Appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure being with you.
Shadi Hamid, joining us from Doha, Qatar, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center. Shadi, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.